We don't know if the Mongolian horse races will be discussed on sports radio, but if they did come up, they might draw some comments from people like the main character of a new movie. Kenneth Turan has our Friday morning review of Big Fan.
The big fan in question is Paul, a 36-year-old Staten Island parking lot attendant. What he really lives for, however, is being a call-in voice on a late-night sports talk radio program.
Let's go to my boy Paul in Staten Island. He always brings the leverage. What's on your mind, brother?
Hey, sports talk, how you doing? I'm just calling to say I can't wait for this Sunday when we finally shut these Philly clowns up once and for all.
Paul's particular hero is a marauding linebacker named Quantrell Bishop. So imagine how excited he is when he catches a glimpse of Bishop at a local gas station and decides on impulse to follow him no matter where it leads. It leads to violence and a visit to the hospital.
So I'm going to be okay?
You sustained some pretty heavy trauma, but longer than you should be. We do need to keep you another few days for observation.
Another few days? How long have I been here?
3 days.
It's not surprising that Robert Siegel is the writer-director behind Big Fan. He's the writer of The Wrestler, and both films share a feeling for the people who live on the fringes of professional sports. With this film, Siegel does the directing himself, and that pays dividends. The filmmaker neither denigrates nor idealizes Paul. He may not even particularly like him, but he does respect the ferocity of his obsessions. Big Fan lets us see Paul as someone who has found something that sustains him, a passion his bourgeois relatives can't understand. Seeing this film brought back a personal memory, a recollection of being a young sports writer for the Washington Post. I was in the press box next to the great essayist Haywood Hale Bruin as 50,000 fans screamed like banshees at a Washington Redskins home opener at RFK Stadium. I gave Bruin a questioning look, and he just shrugged. Speaking elegantly above the din, he said, "To the eternal question, who am I? I am a Redskins fan." Provides a convenient answer. It always has, and if Big Fan is any indication, it likely always will.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. And you can see Paul the Sports Fan tailgate and trash talk in film clips at our website, npr.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up on this 8th anniversary of September 11th, how Americans view Islam. Have opinions evolved over the years as more Americans engage with people of the faith? And as America becomes more religiously diverse, so has the Army. We'll meet the Army's first chaplain who follows the Buddhist faith. But first, back to the issue that's dominated the headlines this summer, health care. After a summer of heated debates and town hall meetings, Congress was back in session this week and met the issue head on, or at least the president insisted they do so. In a speech to a joint session of Congress, President Obama urged members to stop the bickering and find a way to pass a health care overhaul. While there's been much discussion about whether Republicans are actually being constructive participants or just partisan obstructionists in this discussion, especially after one GOP lawmaker yelled at the president during his speech, the truth is that Democrats are divided. And one of the biggest sticking points is whether there should be a government-run insurance plan, a so-called public option, for people who don't have access to private health insurance. We've called on two Democratic members of Congress with very different perspectives to talk this over. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey represents California's 6th District. She's a co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and Congressman Jason Altmaier represents Pennsylvania's 4th District. He's a co-chair of the Task Force on Health Care Reform for the New Democratic Coalition. That's a group of moderates. He's a blue dog. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Congressman Woolsey. I'm going to start with you because in a recent letter to the president, you and Arizona Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva stated that you would not vote for a bill without a public option. And in his speech, the president specifically asked advocates of the public option to be open to other ideas. So what do you say now?
Well, I say I stand behind that letter. The president had in his list of things that will be part of his health care reform a government public insurance option. So we'll work with him on that, and I don't care what it's called. It can be called ice cream for all I care, but what we have to have is something that will bring down the cost, provide competition and more security.
So you're not drawing a line in the sand over a government-run plan per se?
Well, it will be government-run. I mean, it will be a plan that competes with the private insurance carriers, and the best way to do that is with a government-run plan that is probably linked to Medicare for its provider network and modeled after Medicare's rate structure. We have to have something that's in place that can get started right now so that the people who are caught in between already will have a place to go and find the coverage that they need. And it'll be good coverage, and it'll be cost-effective coverage.
So I guess what I'm asking is, what's your bottom line? Is your bottom line universal access somehow, some way, or there has to be a government option?
Well, yes, universal access, but that's the best way to do it is already, we've already worked it out, is a government plan, a public option. You can call it what you want, but it will be backed by the government. Once the government will get it started, the plan will pay back the government, and it will stand on its own, but it will be totally separate from the private industry.
Congressman Altmaier, let's turn to you. You've expressed concern about the cost of these overhaul plans. Did the president's pledge to make any plan deficit neutral address your concerns?
It did. Now, Congress has to write the bill in a way that meets that specification. The Blue Dogs, as a group, have not taken a position on the public option. There's different views on that. But one thing that we have said clearly as a group is that we have to do this in a fiscally responsible way. It cannot add one penny to the deficit. It has to be completely paid for. And we can't raise taxes on individuals and businesses to do this. And we can't impact small businesses in a way that's going to actually harm their bottom line and prevent them from making the steps necessary to offer health care for their employees. And whether or not the public option plays a role in that is yet to be determined. I'm speaking for myself, think that the public option may, if it's done correctly, may be a part of the package and could play a role. As Congresswoman Woolsey described, it would have to be airtight, completely self-sustaining, not funded through taxpayer subsidies, and have to meet all the same insurance regulations. So I don't think that is the sticking point for the Blue Dogs and the moderate members. I think what we are most concerned about is we have to do this in a fiscally responsible way.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means squeezing the costs and the inefficiencies out of the current system, using the savings that you achieve to bring as many people in as possible. But again, you can't raise taxes to do this. You can't impact small businesses in a negative way. And most important, we cannot add one penny to the federal deficit when this process is complete.
Do you credit the argument that cost savings can pay for the plan?
I think that you can squeeze the inefficiencies out of the system and generate enough costs to bring a lot of people into the system. Truth be told, you probably can't do the whole group of 47 million by doing that. But if that's the best we can do, I think that's a big step forward. We would greatly expand the risk pool, make it more fair for the people who have insurance now, and do away with some of these practices with the insurance industries, with pre-existing conditions and lifetime caps and dropping you when you get sick, helping small businesses to pool their employees and bring down their rates. And if we do all of these things together, that's a big step forward.
If you're just tuning in, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about health care with Democratic lawmakers Jason Altmaier and Lynn Woolsey. Jason Altmaier is from Pennsylvania. Lynn Woolsey is from California. We're talking about the substance, but I do want to spend a minute on the politics. I mean, the president made a strong argument that, or at least I think he hoped it was a strong argument, that the time to address this issue is now. He said he hoped to be the last president to have this argument. I wanted to ask each of you is, can you face the voters next fall not having passed a bill? Even if you have strong objections, can you face the voters without having passed a bill? Congressman Woolsey, can I ask you first?
Well, my voters will be very disappointed if we don't have a very good health care reform bill. The majority of them, and this will probably not surprise anybody, I represent Marin and Sonoma, just north of San Francisco, really want a single-payer system. So they would consider a health care bill without at least compromising enough to have a public option, not really health care reform. So they're watching it very carefully, and they do want health care reform, but they want real reform. They don't want tweaking around the edges.
And Congressman Altmaier, you represent a district in which you have a significant population of seniors on Medicare, and we see from the polling that seniors are one of the groups most skeptical of reform groups so far. So some would argue that that takes some of the pressure off of you, that the status quo is working just fine for this group. What do you say to that?
Well, I think everyone has had a personal experience with the healthcare industry that leads them to believe that we can do better, whether it be having a family member in a nursing home that had a bad experience, having to spend an hour on the phone haggling with an insurance claims adjuster who just denied your claim, or a small business who had to make the decision to drop coverage after 4 years of 20-plus percent rate increases. Everyone understands we can do better. But what I hear time and again is we have to preserve what's working in our current system, because there are a lot of things in this country that we do better than anybody else in the world, and we don't want to lose that while we find a way to bring more people into the system and bring down the costs. So I think the worst possible option for my constituents would be to pass a bill that makes the system worse, but a very close second would be to do nothing, because the status quo is simply not acceptable. The cost curve that we're on is unsustainable, and we have to do something to make healthcare more affordable.
You know, listening to the two of you, it does sound as if there's, I mean, it seems like the rhetoric over the summer sounded as if there was just no hope of compromise. But just listening to the two of you, it sounds as if there's a lot of room. What is your sense in talking to your colleagues?
Well, actually, the president gave us our marching orders night before last. And I think as the Democratic caucus in general, we get it. We want to work with him. We have all along, and we're committed to work with him and our leadership. And we can do it. We know we can do it. But we have to make sure we know that our number one goal is to cover all eligible Americans. I mean, if it is, and if we want to have it cost effective and provide competition, there's ways that we know will work. And if we take the politics out of scaring people to death, that we might have a little slice of a government plan which actually saves tens of billions of dollars. Once we start stepping up to what we need and want and what saves money and what costs money, I think we're going to be just fine. We've got three House bills, two of which I support totally. One I'm kind of wishy-washy about, the Energy and Commerce bill, parts of it. But I think when we unite those three bills, we're going to come up with something that Jason and I can work on together. We've worked on other bills together, haven't we, Jason?
That's right.
Okay, but Congressman Woolsey, you're saying that the top priority is to cover everybody, but Congressman Altmaier seems to be saying the top priority is to do no harm to the people who already like what they have. That doesn't seem like the same perspective to me.
Well, no, it isn't, but it won't do any harm. I mean, if we do this right, we will add more security to the people who already have coverage. The argument that people who have coverage, the 85% of the people are covered by their employer, that they totally like their coverage, that's a misconception. But even worse than that, they have this fear in their hearts, and they should, that their employer could decide not to cover them, not them as an individual, but as a group, or they could want to change jobs, the individuals, they could get fired, they could get laid off. Where do they go? We want them to have a place to go and have choice.
We're almost out of time. I did want to ask if Congressman Altmaier could have the last 30 seconds. I apologize. I just want to give him a last word.
Well, again, I would just say that we are all working together. There are very few, if any, members of the Democratic caucus who think that the status quo is the best outcome for this. And we have 535 people that are involved in this process, and you're going to have 535 differences of opinion on what the perfect bill would be. But I share Congresswoman Woolsey's confidence that we will find a way to accommodate everybody's views. We're going to move to a consensus approach, and I believe we're going to get this done.
All right. Thank you. Congressman Jason Altmaier represents Pennsylvania's 4th District. He's also co-chair of the New Democratic Coalition's Task Force on Healthcare Reform. He joined us by phone from Wexford, Pennsylvania. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey represents California's 6th District. She's co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and she joined us by phone from her home office. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Last night, the Pittsburgh Steelers took the first step toward repeating as champions of the National Football League. Before a towel-waving hometown crowd, the Steelers opened the 2009 NFL season by beating the Tennessee Titans in overtime by a score of 13-10. The other 30 NFL teams begin their quest for a Super Bowl title this weekend. And joining us now, as he does most Fridays, is sports writer Stefan Fatsis. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
A pretty exciting game last night. The Steelers quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, completed 33 passes for a whopping 363 yards. Can Pittsburgh, do you think, repeat as champion?
And only one team has done it this decade, New England in the 2003 and 2004 seasons. Two teams did it in the 90s, Denver and Dallas. One in the 80s, San Francisco, but they won four Super Bowls that decade. Three did it in the 70s, and Green Bay, of course, won the first two Super Bowls back in the 60s. It is much harder to repeat now because of player movement via free agency, salary cap rules, a schedule that's designed to promote parity throughout the league. Pittsburgh, though, certainly looks good enough to repeat. They are remarkably stable. They had 19 of 22 starters back from last season last night. But there is so much unpredictable about football, especially injuries. And we saw it last night when the Steelers' great safety, Troy Polamalu, who had a terrific start to the game and to the season, hurt a knee ligament and now might miss 3 to 6 weeks.
The backdrop to this NFL season is labor unrest. The league and the players' union are already exchanging words about a new collective bargaining agreement. Doesn't look too good, I guess.
No, these are not good words. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and the new union boss Demoris Smith traded digs in the media this week. We're still waiting for formal negotiations to begin, and the basic issue is this. The teams voted to opt out of the current labor deal on the grounds that it had proven too favorable financially for the players. And if the two sides can't reach a new agreement by next March, the 2010 season will be played without a salary cap restricting how much or how little teams can spend on players. Now, that's going to be very interesting and possibly very lucrative for a few players, but also very harmful for the vast majority, I think, in the league. And then you've got the possibility of a lockout or a strike in 2011 becoming far more serious.
Why is it so hard for the NFL owners and the players to reach an agreement? It is not for a lack of money sloshing around that they can divide up.
No, certainly not. I mean, $8 billion or close to it in revenue in the NFL now. There is a basic disagreement on how that money should be divided. The owners in this most recent labor deal guaranteed the players around 60% of certain league revenue. They now claim that actual player costs are even higher than that. The union says this is perfectly equitable. We are the players. We are the entertainment. And you've got this tug of war. What's going to complicate matters on the owner's side is that they have a big internal issue to address, and that's how much revenue teams should share with one another between the bigger market and smaller market or smaller revenue clubs. This, I think, is the elephant in the room for the owners as this labor issue gets going.
Now, finally, the NFL enacted restrictions on players, coaches, and other team personnel. They may not use social media like Twitter from 90 minutes before kickoff until after post-game media interviews are completed. Why are they anti-Twitter?
Well, part of the reason was Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chad Ochocinco, formerly Chad Johnson, of course. He promised over the summer to tweet during games. Now, Ocho, as many fans know, is something of an attention lover. After these new rules came out, he announced that he was going to close his Twitter account, which has 159,000 followers. Then he didn't do that, of course, and said that he had found loopholes in the NFL rule. And yesterday he tweeted, "You ain't seen nothing yet, poor no fun league. I'm itching for Sundays so bad."
No fun league is what NFL stands for. For him.
Right.
Okay. Stefan, thanks a lot. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Robert. You too.
Stefan Fatsis is the author of A Few Seconds of Panic, A Sports Writer Plays in the NFL.
Today is the 8th anniversary of 9/11. 8 years ago, 10 days after that tragic event, Terry Gross spoke to poet Robert Haas, and we'd like to replay parts of their conversation today. Terry wanted to know, at that depressing and frightening time, if there were any poems Robert Haas was turning to. He was America's poet laureate from 1995 to 1997. He also translated poetry and edited the book Best American Poetry 2001. Terry called him at his home on September 21, 2001, and he told her he had spoken recently at a memorial service attended by 12,000 people at the University of California at Berkeley, where he teaches. Terry asked what he had said at that service.
You know, I think I said that we were a community of that took its meaning from teaching and learning, and it seemed like the lessons of the last week are ones that I don't know if they can be taught. The courage and resourcefulness of the policemen and the firemen and the ambulance drivers and doctors and nurses were one of the most powerful things about the weekend. I don't know if there's any way to teach people to respond that way. You know, one hopes that one would. That was one thing. And another was that way in which it just brought us up against the mystery of our lives, the way death does, you know, people going about their business. One friend of a friend described on the internet his being saved by, at the last minute, deciding not to go into a meeting because he passed a bakery two blocks away where he smelled cinnamon rolls, which he resisted the scent of. And then when he got to the World Trade Center and was about to go into the building, he thought, oh, what the hell, and turned around and wandered back toward the scent of cinnamon buns. One, you know, reads the stories about everybody, the person who just was phoning a wife and the person who was just starting to trade bonds and the person who was just booting up their computer, suddenly gone. So, finding a language for that. And I had just seen in the New Yorker a translation of a poem of Czesław Miłosz that I had done with him. This is a poem written when he was 89 that I thought spoke to this, you know, for this mystery of what, who we are, what our lives are. So I read that poem. It's called In a Parish.
Can you read it for us?
Sure. Were I not frail and half broken inside, I wouldn't be thinking of them who are, like me, half broken inside. I would not climb the cemetery hill by the church to get rid of my self-pity, crazy Sophies, Michaels who lose every battle, self-destructive Agathas lie under crosses with their dates of birth and death. And who is going to express them, their mumblings, weepings, hopes, tears of humiliation, in hospital muck and the smell of urine, with their weak and contorted limbs and eternity close by? Improper, indecent, like a dollhouse crushed by wheels, like an elephant trampling a beetle, an ocean drowning an island. Our stupidity and childishness do nothing to fit us for the sobriety of last things. They had no time to grasp anything of their individual lives, any principium individuationis, nor do I grasp it. Yet what can I do? Enclosed all my life in a nutshell, trying in vain to become something completely different from what I was. Thus, we go down into the earth, my fellow parishioners, with the hope that the trumpet of judgment will call us by our names. Instead of eternity, greenness, and the movement of clouds, they rise then, thousands of Sophies, Michaels, Matthews, Marias, Agathas, Bartholomews, so that at last they know why and for what reason.
Robert Haas, reading the Czesław Miłosz poem In a Parish, recorded in 2001, 10 days after 9/11. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. We'll close with this recording by bassist Charlie Hayden.
So that's healthcare and semantics with the choice of one word. We had a two-word view on healthcare from a certain Republican South Carolina congressman this week, and now we move to three words. This week, a website called FiLife.com launched a Twitter contest to reduce policy on how to fix healthcare to a mere three words. Some entries so far?
Promote healthy living and eat an apple are two examples.
Another entry focuses on Americans' eating habits.
Stop eating McDonald's, it proclaims. Still other three-word entries target our bureaucracy. Among them,
cut red tape. No more lobbyists.
There are some actual strategies for changing the way medical needs are met, such as allow more competition, cap medical malpractice, more affordable medication, same for all, and make it universal.
Then come some entries from people against a health care overhaul. They include these: quit being wusses and leave it alone.
Our staff made up some three-word policy proclamations: doctors make less and Cuban health care. We asked for some more three-word health policy statements from people with an interest in the topic. First, from the president of the American Medical Association, Dr. James Rohack.
My three words are quality, affordable, coverage.
This is Wendell Potter. I'm senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy and a former health insurance executive. My three-word solution is American health security.
I'm Rob Farley. I'm a reporter with PolitiFact.com. Doesn't kill granny.
Three-word summaries of the healthcare debate. The Phi Life contest closes September 16th. Five winners will be announced, and they'll each get a $100 prize.
And finally, today we want to take a moment to remember 9/11. It was 8 years ago this morning that hijacked planes slammed into the towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, the Pentagon just outside of Washington, and into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. For many of us, recollections of that day are seared into memory. Our own fears, the faces of survivors and desperate relatives wandering through the dust and debris in Lower Manhattan, images of smoke and fire rising from the wall of the Pentagon. The grief mixed with pride over the passengers who wrestled control of the United Airlines Flight 93 away from their terrorist captors, preventing another possible strike against the nation's capital. Now the nation lives in a post-9/11 world, something most of us are reminded of when our bags are searched at the museum entrance, or as we take off our shoes in the airport security line, or take in news reports from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But for the families whose loved ones died in those attacks, the post-9/11 world represents a more intimate, devastating, and ever-present change. That morning, they each lost a precious part of themselves, a loss that now greets them every morning of their lives. So today, we'd like to pause to remember with them. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracken Booker, Monica Evstatieva, Jasmine Garst, Irva Gunja, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Jennifer Longmire, Enrique Rivera, and Jack Zahora. And this week we welcome intern Monica Anderson. Our planning editor is Luis Clemens. Our senior producers are Peter Breslow, Cindy Johnston, and Alicia Montgomery. The program is directed by Rob Sachs. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. She had a hand this week from Neil Tewald and Gregory Gavin. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior producer is Tashima Walker. Special thanks to Jennifer Ludden for hosting earlier this week. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.